Do you know the author?
No, I don't, and I don't know the title either. But it's a blue book, and it kind of gives the whole story, you know.
Have you a real love of books and learning?
Welcome to episode 19 of Adventures in Library Instruction. This is October. This really is October 2010. And we're trying something a little bit different this time. We invited all of our past guests. We were a little shocked at how many past guests we've had, looking back over the last 18 episodes. And we just sent out a mass email and invited anybody who wanted to come back and join us. So we'll do this sort of tea is for training style as a group conversation. A couple of our guests have commitments that they need to leave in about half an hour. And so we're going to start off with them. First of all, the three regulars, we're going to introduce ourselves, and then we'll introduce our three guests very briefly and get into the conversation. So I'm Jason Puckett. I'm at Georgia State University Library in Atlanta, and I'm the communication librarian, and I blog very irregularly lately at jasonpuckett.net.
I am Anna Vanskoik. I am a part-time public librarian at a county library system in the lovely state of New Jersey, and I blog at firstconclusions.com.
And I am Rachel Borchard. I'm the science librarian at American University, and as usual, I do not blog, but I tweet very irregularly right now at Butternut Squash.
Okay, Chad, we'll start with you if you want to just introduce yourself real brief, please.
Okay, my name's Chad Marin. I'm a librarian and part-time faculty member at St. Petersburg College in Florida. I blog kind of occasionally. I'm on Twitter most of the time at cmarin, C-M-A-I-R-N. So check me out if you can.
Cool, thanks. And Peter?
I'm Peter Larson. I am the Physical Sciences and Education Librarian and Associate Professor at the University of Rhode Island, and I neither blog nor tweet.
Oh, my God. You know it's the 21st century, right?
You know, even I don't care about my life so much as to blog or tweet about it, so I can't expect anyone else to.
Awesome. And last but certainly not least, Stephen Frankur.
Hi, I'm an information services librarian. My name is Stephen Frankur, and I work at Brooke College. I blog at Digital Reference and also at Beating the Bounds. I'm more on FriendFeed than Twitter, but you can find me on Twitter as well.
Awesome. Thanks, you guys, all for joining us. And if you want to add any of your blogs or tweets or anything into the show notes, we will be happy to link them from there. So we just decided that our topic for today is just going to be what are you doing that you're interested in or excited about right now? And we'll just sort of see where the conversation takes us from there. So I think we'll just ask Chad first, and if you want to talk about anything real briefly, and then we'll go to Peter since you guys have early commitments, and hopefully we can talk to both of you before you need to leave.
Okay. A couple things that I've been working on lately. I manage all the databases behind the scenes at the college. And we have a lot of issues with people accessing them and all this. So I created a database troubleshooting libguide, and I'll put that on the show notes, the link to it. But what I've done is I have all the troubleshooting tips on the left that ask people to try these things if I'm not online. But I log in every morning using Meebo. I think we all probably use something similar. But then what I've done is underneath that is I've added an embedded way to screen share, which I'm using Yugu, and I'll add that link as well. But what this does is this allows me to just simply say, hey, create a screen name, and I'll send you a link through instant messaging, and then I can actually share my screen with them if they're having really technical issues.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and then if it gets even crazier, like if I have to make changes and they're very timid, you know, and not understanding what I'm talking about, then I can actually send them another link and then request control of their computer and make changes that way. So that's it's gaining in popularity. Just I've only had it up for 2 weeks. And it's actually now there's a link inside our course management system, which is great. So that's been getting a lot of use. I can only imagine what's going to happen when it gets more popular. I've also been using Poll Everywhere to try to have more interaction and just basic library instruction. What I'm trying to gauge is to try to figure out what student attitudes are towards research before a library instruction, and then I actually send them a follow-up survey to see if what we do actually helps them with academic research. And so with Poll Everywhere, I'm able to do like a almost like an American Idol kind of voting thing where they can use their phones and they can use Twitter if they want, or they can just use the web. And I also bring in the old-fashioned piece of paper that says, hey, just, you know, bubble in this bubble thing here. There's only two questions. But it really is a way for me to kind of gauge where they think they are and then gauge where they are after the fact. And it's been pretty successful. The only issue I've had is I sometimes hear crickets in the background when I ask them to text something, and we're told that our users are savvy with mobile technologies, and so far I haven't really seen it, to be honest with you. But anyway, once they figure out where to text the keyword to and they see it embedded in the PowerPoint and actually moving the statistics around, they have a blast with it.
This almost sounds like assessment, Chad.
It is. Yes. Yeah, and it's fun. It's really fun.
This is so funny. I've heard – this is the third time in 2 weeks I've heard librarians talk about Poll Everywhere. This seems to have just really be making the rounds. We've had two candidates come in for a job recently that involves instructional technologies, and they've both been talking about Poll Everywhere. I'm sorry, is it Poll Anywhere or Poll Everywhere?
Poll Everywhere.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, PollEverywhere.com. And one thing, I've been using just the free version, and the other day I was going to go, I want to try the report system here, and I clicked on the report link, and then it said, oh, you know, to get this, you have to have a premium account, and it was like $1,400.
So I was like, sure.
Yeah, I'm not going to go that way. I'll make my own reports, I guess. A couple other quick little things. I'm getting ready to teach a for-credit honors library research class.
Cool.
And it's actually going to be a required course for the Honors College, which is great. But what I want to do is I want the students to, throughout the whole semester, I want them to design their own textbook. And we're going to use a wiki, and I'm just going to say, hey, here's the parameters, but I want you to go out and find the articles and make sure they're peer-reviewed and all that kind of thing. But I want you, my students, to create this textbook and just see how that works. It's an experiment. I don't know how it's going to work. But I think when they take control of their own textbook, it might be interesting. Who knows? And maybe we could actually use it in a class next year. I don't know. We'll see. So that's something I'm gonna play with next semester.
That's interesting. Are you gonna have certain parameters in place for it, or is it just kind of a run with scissors, go whatever you come up with?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm probably going to have some parameters set up saying, hey, you know, we need to cover these topics. We need to discuss this and all that. And then maybe I'll give them like a little sandbox to say, hey, go out there and put some stuff in here that's, you know, just interesting to you and just see what we can do. You know, I'm going to try to get them all using Twitter. I have a lot of students that do use Twitter. It's extra credit right now. But once they get into it, it's interesting. But I might maybe embed their stream somewhere too. So it's kind of a live textbook, too.
How many students are you talking about in this class?
There's probably going to be 24.
Okay.
Yeah. I also have them edit Wikipedia articles, too. Obviously using good resources and actually making sure they cite their sources and everything. So then hopefully they're adding to the general encyclopedia. At first, they're very scared to do it, but once they start doing their research and go, wow, you know, I can actually add to this and maybe somebody will build on it, then they get pretty excited.
That's one of my favorite exercises people do, just because then it gives them, it lets them wrap their head around that anybody can contribute to Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. And just kind of the, and also that they're adding to this knowledge base that's there. I just think it's this kind of an ownership, sense of ownership that they get.
Exactly. Well, or this work is getting erased by an obsessive person with a finger on the revert button, which is another kind of lesson, you know.
It's one thing to be told that or to know, you know, intellectually know that, that anybody can edit this thing, but it's another thing to go in and build it or make changes to it. I've heard of that as an assignment before, too, and I think that's just a really neat idea.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, I'll let you know how it works out. The wiki textbook and maybe integrate it somehow with Wikipedia. That'll be fun.
Well, let us know when you've made some progress or feel like you're ready to talk about the wiki textbook again, because I would love to have you back on to talk about that when you've when you've got some more time.
Yeah.
You know, you're troubleshooting LibGuide. To get back to the first thing that you were talking about, my first thought, of course, being the Zotero geek, is, wow, I could get access to somebody's Zotero screen or show them my screen via IM instead of having them to try to, you know, describe to me in broken IM language what's going on their screen. That sounds really cool.
Yeah, so, and Yugu's free. You get, I think, 100
that's
minutes.
That's amazing.
100 minutes per month. And I've only gone over my minutes 1 month. And I told my director, I was like, hey, you know, since I'm doing this and it's college-wide, and I am getting questions about our course management system, and I'm like, well, maybe we need to add another link underneath there, you guys, that goes to the help desk. But I told her, I said, if I go over 100 minutes, which I probably will, can we buy an actual account? And she said that we could do that. So hopefully, you know, I want it to go over 100 minutes, you know, because it's a really innovative way to show these students how to do it. And because, you know, we don't want them to jump through all the access hoops, because then they get to the point where they're like, okay, I spent 25 minutes getting to this database. Now I gotta figure out how to use it to find stuff. So at least if we eliminate all the access hoops, or at least try to eliminate a lot of them, then they can spend more time reading materials and thinking about their topics and that kind of thing. That's my goal, at least.
That was my thought when people were like piloting Question Point at libraries that I was working at for virtual reference, and it was like create an account and then log in, and it's like they're not going to jump through all these hoops just to you know get help. They're just going to give up and wander away.
Mm-hmm.
That's always what I thought. So that's really cool. If you found a low barrier, I'm going to have to try that out. That's really neat.
Well, and I think that's really important. You know, it's like I wasn't sure I was going to actually get Skype installed and an account set up and stuff for this conversation, you know, and I do this for a living. And I think, you know, if I was telling my students, oh, my God, you've got to learn Skype now, they'd be like, ah, and like half of them would never find it, and it would just be insane. So it's like you got to look for those low barrier things or things that you can use within things they've already kind of passed the barrier for to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Well, we always tell guests on the podcast, all you have to do is log into Skype, and then we'll do the rest. You know, we'll get you onto the call. And
we may fumble a bit, but we'll get you.
We always do, yeah, but. Well, let's talk to Peter a little bit. I hate to move on so quickly, but I
know
you guys have limited time. But let's, Peter, what are you working on that's interesting or exciting that you want to talk about today?
My big breakthrough that I'm kind of excited about recently was that my students, I teach a full semester, 3-credit information literacy research methods course pretty much every semester. And I've been working on moving as much of it online as possible. We still do face-to-face classes, but I now they don't buy a textbook. All the reading is basically built into the course modules. And actually, this ties into a whole idea that I think that universities have the opportunity to essentially get out from under textbook publishers. You know, I think that there's the possibility that, you know, instead of having say 500 students a year buy a $200 chemistry textbook, why aren't we charging them an additional $100 to provide them with an online version of our chemistry text?
The state of California, if I recall, has been working on an open access I don't remember what subject. I think they were doing a series of these open access online textbooks that were funded by the state. And, you know, they were all being vetted and edited very carefully, but it was going to be something that they were going to offer as a free online textbook. I think that the textbook publishers must just be really shaking because they're going to have to find a new business model soon.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that we've got, and this is actually a little tangential to what I wanted to talk about, but I think it's something that I want people thinking about, is that, you know, we seem to assume, or the assumption among a lot of people seems to be that the internet means that we are going to be, you know, in hock to the commercial publishers forever, right? There seems to be very slow movement towards the idea that the internet means that, for example, commercial publishing of journal articles could end theoretically tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we wouldn't have to spend $35,000 a year buying an Elsevier neuroscience journal, you know, that we actually have the opportunity, you know, actually today to start distributing this stuff in a different way because, frankly, the scholarly work on those journals are pretty much done by scholars for little or no recompense,
mm-hmm.
right? So anyway, so I don't want to get in too much into the open access thing, but this idea that you know, we've been outsourcing our pedagogy via textbooks for, you know, 110 years, 120 years. We don't have to do that anymore. We can actually take back our pedagogy and do it in-house, and I bet we could make it at least break even. And we could cut the students a significant break. Anyway, so that's kind of one idea that's kind of percolated in the back of my head. The big breakthrough I had myself was that my class, like I said, is online, and they're working on a group project. And a student said, you know, is there part of the course management software, we use Sakai, that we can store stuff so our team members can work on it? And there is, but I don't have it set up. And I'm like, well, let's see, how can I do that I know I'm going to be able to get into place in time for you guys to actually get some use out of it? And then I'm like, wait a minute, we've migrated all the student email accounts to Gmail. And they're like, so? And I'm like, well, you all have access to Google Documents.
Oh.
Right.
I'm like, just start a document and then share it with your teammates and you can collaboratively work on this document, you know, anytime you want. And they said, we can do that? And I'm like, yes, this is how you do it. So click on this, and, you know. And then I stopped, and I sort of showed the class how to do it. And I was just talking with some of my colleagues about it. And one of them was saying that she actually did that a previous year. And what she did is she actually set up the documents for them and then shared the document to each group mm-hmm. so they could start working on it, which not only let them work together collaboratively on the document, it let her go back and look at the history. And so for evaluation purposes, she could say, well, you know, students A and B put a lot of work into this, but student C did nothing. Or student C didn't do as much.
Yeah.
What did student C do as part of the group? And maybe the group would say, well, student C did, you know, he did this part or she did this other thing that was, you know, she wrote out the script for the presentation for all of us. Or,
right.
You
it
know.
Might not have right. manifested in the document itself, but it was...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or if there's a dispute where, you know, two students say, student C didn't do anything, and I look at the document, I go, student C did a heck of a lot of work. I mean, student C's in here editing constantly. What beef do you have against, you know, because sometimes it's just people don't get along and they start saying crappy
right.
things about each other. And so it's suddenly I'm like, oh, my God, Google Documents, because the students are already – they're already using that tool, so they already have access to it. I don't have to be like, and guess what? Another login and password. Yay, you. You know, I can say it's already built into the function or the thing you're already using. You just don't know about it because you've never clicked on that link.
I would have loved that level of engagement in my professors in library school because we used Google Docs constantly. I was amazed at how many of my classmates didn't know about Google Docs, mm-hmm. and we were in a distance ed program, and we were doing so much group work. I would really have loved for our professors to come in and look at the Google Doc to see what people were doing. That would have been great.
And, you know, of course, they're increasing other things. There's spreadsheets and stuff. And I mean, so there's a lot more – it's a lot more – flexible than it was, you know, even 3 or 4 years ago when I started using Google Documents for work stuff. And so that's kind of exciting. another idea that I've got that this is just another crazy idea that I've thrown out. We have a media lab that's been not in the library but on campus that's been put together, and they're kind of looking for stuff for people to do, right? They built the service and they have some users, but they want more. And I haven't gotten to this point yet, but I sort of have this dream that after I introduce students to various things they need to know, like this is how you use the catalog, this is how you find books, this is what a call number is, all this stuff, I'm thinking of putting an assignment in where they basically have to go to the media lab and work with the media lab to produce a 3-minute video explaining something. And then the winners will get put up online, right? And then the next semester they'll be competing with the previous people to do a better explanation of that online, you know, is it like a 3-minute YouTube video, with the idea of slowly building a collection of, you know, the library explained in nothing over 3 minutes. And that way, you know, simultaneously the students are getting their work out there and they're seeing their work actually being useful to people. Secondly, I think people might use it more than static guides. And thirdly, I get somebody else to do the work that I don't have time to do to design those guides. So it's kind of like a win-win-win-win-win situation, at least in my mind, right? And like I said, this is still in the sort of crazy planning stage, but I would like to, you know, I would like to give it a crack. Probably not next semester, but maybe the spring after that, have this thing up and running. So, you know, the students can actually get some experience with the technology that they otherwise don't use.
You know, one thing I love about this, I'm sorry, Anna, is I think it was a few months ago, I was trying to find, I think, just a general 3-minute type of overview of what is information literacy. And I was really surprised at how few of those videos there are on YouTube. Like, just something to show your students to get them start talking about, you know, what is the library, what do we do, and what is this class about. So it sounds like something like that would be not only good for a short introduction, but I love that it would be done by students, because then they're all speaking the same language. It's kind of like I can remove myself at that point, you know, in my jargony ways.
Well, right, and making it into sort of a competition then also I think gets the students more excited, and it theoretically gives the students something to point back to. You know, let's say, and the idea was that I would keep links to the, you know, no longer the best one kind of thing, you know, the honorable mentions kind of, or previous winners. And so it would be, there'd be a link online that a student could say if they were applying to a job where this was remotely relevant, of which I think there are increasingly more jobs like that, would be able to go say, well, here, my work was good enough to appear on the library's website, you know, so my teacher thought it was good enough that it was actually used to, you know, do this, this, and this. And so it actually would have a material benefit to the student apart from, you know, I got an A on my assignment or I got a B on my assignment or whatever, and that was, you know, 8% of my grade for one course I took one semester in my, you know, years of college, right? Instead, it's like something you could theoretically look back to and say, well, hey, you know, I did this kind of thing. Because I had projects like that in library school, which certainly contributed to my getting hired for, you know, my first couple of library jobs. So I was able to say, well, here's proof.
And they're going to remember that work and that assignment a lot more than they would, you know, just a regular paper kind of thing. That's really going to stick with them.
Now, you know, I can only hope that actually it gets, you know, I actually get around to doing this. You know, that's, like I said, at the moment it's easy to talk about it, but getting all the ducks in a row to actually see it, you know, see reality, I don't know if that's going to happen, but it's kind of my dream, so.
Peter, I have a quick question for you about the course that you're doing. You said it was online this time. Is it normally online when you've done it in the past?
This is a programmatic course. We have taught up to, I think, 18 sections a year. Currently, we're down a little bit because we're short some people. And it We do teach it both fully online and in person.
Okay.
And I teach an in-person course, but I am relying increasingly on the course management software for, you know, delivery of quizzes, for instead of having them buy a textbook of which they're using a few sections, I have basically created my modules to fill in those sections. So I'm saving them, you know, $25 or $30 from buying this guide. And, you know, every semester I'm adding more stuff to make it more robust. So the idea is to kind of ease my way into having essentially an online textbook that I'm going to be using for these students.
That's what I remember from your, when we talked with you last time, was that it was a full course that you were doing. And I just remember being very impressed with your ongoing assessment that you were doing through. I mean, it wasn't, here's a couple of weeks, now we're going to do some type of test or something. I mean, you really were. It was a consistent assessment that you were constantly getting feedback from your students. And I'm assuming that Sakai allows you to do that as well.
Yes, to some degree. And I can actually only praise Mary McDonald, our head of instruction.
Oh, she is just fabulous. I love Mary McDonald.
Isn't she? Mary McDonald is so wonderful. And you guys really should have her on the show. I mean, you should. I highly recommend that. She's very, very concerned about assessment, mm-hmm. and she kind of keeps us all pointing in the same direction. You know, I would be half the instruction librarian if I was without Mary McDonald. Anyway, and with that, I'm afraid I have to run off. So
okay, well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Peter. This all really sounds very, like, really interesting stuff you're doing.
Absolutely.
And, you'll have to rejoin us again on a future show and let us know how this is all going.
I had actually a great time, and I would love to do this again in perhaps a time where I had more time. So,
you bet.
Okay.
Thanks, Peter.
Cool. Thanks, Peter. So, Stephen, we'll move on to you. Thank you for being patient and going last in this conversation. But the benefit is we've got more time with you. We've got a half hour or so. So, tell us what you're working on that you're interested in and excited about at the moment.
Well, at the moment, I'm really excited about an article that was recommended to me by some staff at the Writing Center at Baruch College, where I work. I've been working with the Writing Center to run a series of workshops for students writing undergraduate honors theses. And I've had interactions in the past a little bit with the Writing Center, but it's the first time I've ever worked on a project with them. And those guys are just amazing. I feel like I've been learning all sorts of stuff that's helping me rethink how I want to approach student research when I'm working with students. And the most important thing that they've passed on to me is this article by a composition instructor who's now at BU, Joseph Bizup is his name. And he wrote this great article called BEAM, A Rhetorical Vocabulary for Teaching Research-Based Writing. And it was published in 2008 in a journal called Rhetoric Review. And I assume you guys will be able to link to the article in the show notes. I actually just wrote a quick blog post about this, which I've been meaning to do as well last night when I should have been going to bed. The short story about the model is that the author takes issue with the traditional ways that we teach students about sources of primary versus secondary and sometimes even tertiary, that those terms are confusing. The definition of those two terms varies from discipline to discipline. And instead, he proposes a model of talking about sources that focuses more on how the sources are used in a paper. And the BEAM model is an acronym for the different kinds of sources. So B is for background, E is for exhibit, A is for argument, and M is for method. So if you're going to be teaching students about, say, how to do literary criticism, an example of a student paper that might include different kinds of sources in that model would be the background sources would say maybe be a biography about the author, something that provides facts that the student wants to present as facts to the reader. Like, here's just background sort of context information. Evidence or exhibits might be a play, for example, that the student is analyzing or interpreting. So these are sources that are actually being worked on and interpreted by the student and the source of the claims that they might be making in their paper. Argument sources can easily be thought of as the sources that offer the discourse about that particular work that's being discussed in the exhibit. So you might have other works of literary criticism that talk about that same play. And then method might be sources that where the student wants to say, this is the sort of methodological approach or the terminology that I'm going to follow in analyzing and interpreting the exhibit at hand. So it's a very functional way for students to think about sources. And what's great about it is it has two immediate uses. One is when you're teaching students how to write, it's a way it gives them a more complete way to think about the kinds of sources they need to find and the kinds of and how they will employ those sources in the service of their writing. But the flip side, another use that I thought was really genius, is that it's a great way for students to do critical reading of a source itself. So if you give the students a source, and you can say, okay, now let's look at the sources being used in this particular work, this article that we're all reading, and let's analyze it using the Beam model and identify the background sources, the exhibits, the arguments, and the method sources as a way of sort of teasing out the author's argument and thinking more critically about the claims that the author is making. So when I read this article, which just kind of blew my mind thinking about this whole new way of thinking about sources, immediately I started thinking, well, this is great. I can use this in the credit course that I teach and also in the workshops that I teach. But I began to realize that this might be useful at the reference desk and other reference service points too, in working with students, trying to get them to think about the sources they have and the sources they may still need to make the claims they want to make in their writing. Mm-hmm. So that's something that's I'm still unfolding this concept and what I want to how I actually want to present it, but it's got me completely energized.
Well, I see in the I'm just skimming your blog post while you're talking about this, Stephen. And I see this makes a lot of sense. You're talking about how students come to the reference desk and they're looking for articles that are exactly written on their topic, and there may not be anything that there may not be anybody who's written about exactly the same topic that they're writing about, and the way that we have to explain to them, well, you may be able to take relate articles that are related in some way and the different ways that you can apply to them, that's something that's hard to explain, especially to a novice researcher, an underclassman, undergraduate or something like that. I'm sort of struggling with that a little bit with one of the classes that I'm working with that's doing PR research and a communication class, obviously, and they're looking for articles about particular companies, and there may not be like a quantitative study about this particular company. I'm having to try and explain to them, well, you can find, similar methodologies that are related or that are applicable, maybe is a better word, and ways that you can apply that. And this seems like if you can find a way to convey this concisely to an undergraduate student, this seems like a really good way to sort of help them break out of that thinking that I have to find articles on the same topic and then cite those same articles on the same topic that I'm writing about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think trying to work with this model at the reference desk is going to be the real challenge because time is of the essence. You got to move, or otherwise you're going to lose the interest of the student rather quickly. But if they have time and there is a concise way to convey this, I think I'm actually envisioning like maybe a handout that I can give them. Like we've already have kind of like a reference desk handout that we use with our students to help them when we're helping them to construct searches and think about information producers. So I'm thinking maybe there's a section we could put on there about the sources where they can start to think about like, okay, I need to find some background sources and what are my exhibits and what are my argument sources and what are my method sources. And so it kind of schematizes the research process and makes things maybe a little bit less nebulous rather than just, I have to go find five sources. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, what do you want those sources to do anyway? So it's trying to push the students along that path of thinking about, well, what do you really want the sources for? I mean, is it just to have to, so you can tick them off in your bibliography? Mm-hmm. Or how will you employ them in your paper? And I'm, I, I So I'm thinking of a way that might incorporate that into some sort of a worksheet that I can have, I can use at the desk, you know, as appropriate with students in the reference interactions.
But that seems like something, if it would be a challenge at the reference desk, which I totally agree with you on that, that it seems like something that you could incorporate into a class discussion, even for a one-shot.
Oh, yeah.
That seems really doable for even a 50-minute one-shot session. If you can, especially if you could come up with some sort of exercise where they're classifying different kinds of articles or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, and that sounds like something Rachel or Anna would probably do a better job than I would.
I don't know, it just sounds like it gives them, I think a lot of times they don't have a game plan when they're starting their research. They just kind of dive in head first, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then when you find your over your head information, I love this idea of it kind of gives them a, this is how I can put my strategy together on the information that I found. And how it's going to fit into the bigger picture. I mean, it really gives that bigger picture, especially in our classes that focus so much on the steps, the little things, the, you know, step here, go here, go here, go here, where this really is more the big picture. It kind of gives them an overview, which I think that we need more of that when we're talking about this stuff.
I absolutely agree. And what I keep thinking about is our freshmen who often have very non-academic subjects that they want to write about. And it seems like this would do a really good job of bridging the gap between what are the mm-hmm. arguments you want to make and what is the actual literature that you could kind of tie back into. It just gives a nice framework for setting up mm-hmm. how to start thinking about how they're going to research their topic. Because I feel like that's one of the big areas that they struggle in, that they don't know how to translate their topic into something that's researchable mm-hmm. all the time. So I'd love it.
It also seems like when you get to I'm a bad academic librarian. I've forgotten which of the for the ACRL standards. I think, is it standard 3 that's about evaluation and assessment of sources, or is that 2?
Oh God, I certainly don't know.
At least you know this stuff by like chapter and verse.
Yeah,
I always have to look it up.
I always have to look it up too.
But it certainly also speaks to evaluation of sources and getting students to think about like. To taking the time to actually think about what they've found.
Absolutely.
As opposed to just like, you know, let me just quickly gather up some crap and I'll string it together. And even if they have done that, it gives them a framework in which to string it together intelligently.
Well, that's the thing. We tell students evaluate your sources and we talk about some of the things you should look at, but this really gives them more of somebody said game plan. It gives them more of a method for doing that. And I think that's what I've been really lacking when I talk to students about evaluating sources is it's easy for me to say that because I have sort of a sense of how to do that, but giving them a method, you know, put it into one of these boxes, and not just evaluating for quality, but evaluating for how you're going to use it. And I think that would speak to students a lot more clearly than evaluating for quality would, because they just, you know, they were told, well, we need 5 sources, mm-hmm. so I'm going to find a list of 5 sources. But if they can, you know, if you can explain to them, this is going to be how you can apply it to making the paper better, mm-hmm. I think that might speak to them a lot more clearly. I really like that about it.
I think the evaluation of sources, too, and I know I was very, very guilty of this in my days at teaching at the academic libraries, is it seems that we would focus so much more on the web, the World Wide Web, on evaluating sources, not necessarily, you know, you have to, there's bias in everything. There's bias in this book that was written by this professor. I mean, there's bias everywhere. And I think that's what's interesting about it, is that it really does take it, it pushes those parameters and that you do have to evaluate everything that you're looking at and look at it critically beyond, you know, the bias, et cetera, but how is this going to fit into my paper?
Yeah, it gives you sort of another axis beyond just looking. I mean, once you've gotten to the academic sources, even once you're at that point, it gives you another kind of axis on the graph of how useful is this going to be to me and in what way is it going to be mm-hmm. useful, mm-hmm. which is really interesting.
There were a couple of – towards the end of the article, he starts getting into this model is a – there's a section of BEAM as a framework for writing in which he's sort of making claims about basically the best way for students to start on topics or start writing based on where they are. So he argues that first and second year students generally do best he tells them not to proceed. He tells them to proceed not by picking topics at the outset, but by pursuing the often unexpected lines of inquiry that emerge from their encounters with concrete sources. And so he wants them to like focus on the exhibit sources and develop questions based on that, which I find a little, I guess I'm a little skeptical about. If you throw a student into Chaucer and they've got no background, no context, mm-hmm. you know, but I think he's, you know, he does make a good point about later on in the article. I hope you don't mind me quoting, but he puts it much better than I can. He says that students who develop writing projects from background sources run the risk of writing mere vanilla reports. If they cannot move beyond these sources, they can do little else. Students who begin from method sources begin with procedures or perspectives in search of applications. They begin with nothing in particular to write about and no one in particular to write for, to, or against. So he really wants them to start with either exhibits or, if they have to, start with argument sources. And I like that focus on argument sources too, because I think the other thing that's hard to convince students of is that that there are these conversations going on in among people who've written in the past, commenting on each other's work. And so by talking about argument sources, it's another way to get at that, I think, really essential notion that we want our students to get, that, hey, there's like this discourse going on that you're tapping into, and believe it or not, you're actually joining into it when you start to write and work with those sources in your own writing.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we could emphasize to students that research is a conversation, is an argument, that it might be more interesting to them. Their own work that they're producing and reading these articles, if they can be thinking about it in terms of something that they could argue against, it might be, you know, it might make the research process more interesting for them. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, as we're talking about this, this would be a really, really cool, I want to go to this conference session, but if not, maybe one of us needs to put it together. This would be a great conference session, taking this theoretical framework and turning it into classroom exercises and classroom discussions, because I'm all about, okay, I need some practical framework for this. How can mm-hmm. I apply it in the classroom? Does he talk, and I just sent myself the citation, does he talk in the article any about how he has applied it in the classroom?
Yeah, he does. He talks about three different articles in which he asks the students to identify the sources and the way that they're being used following the Beam model, and points out the complexities of the argument that the author is making that are revealed by this sort of analysis. So, I mean, and the most practical level, the way I think I might use it, is I might actually have the students read an article, something short. I should mention that I'm teaching a 3-credit course again this semester, that this year is composed entirely of freshmen. So I might have them read an article and identify the sources and just put like a little B next to every source that's a background, being used for background, and an E next to the exhibit sources, et cetera, and then have them talk about how they identify them and have a conversation in class about, to see where there's agreement and disagreement about the identification of sources in this article.
That, of course, presupposes that you can get them to read the articles for a one-shot. For you, it's a lot easier if you're actually grading them and can quiz them on. But if you can get, you know, professor buy-in and say, okay, we're going to quiz you guys on this. This is your homework for the library session. I think our students would rebel if they had homework for a library class. But if we could get the professor to buy in, which I think I could do in some cases.
Yeah. Yeah, I think thinking up of like a practical application of a one-shot is kind of a fun challenge. I hadn't given that a whole lot of thought. Although I've got some coming up next month, so I've got to quickly figure out how I might incorporate this for an activity as opposed to just me lecturing about it.
I think one way I could see using it in a one-off is I feel like one of our big roles as academic institutions, not even as librarians, is to kind of help students get the transition from kind of passive learning, which is, I think, mostly what they get in high school. Like, these are the facts. Now you're going to spit them back into what you guys are talking about of, like, it's true, into taking an active role in that they are actual researchers and they're adding to the discussion. It's not just them reading what other people have done, but it's also what they think about what other people have done. So I feel like it's one tool that we can use to try and get that across. Because I feel like we kind of skip over that a lot and just kind of assume that they're aware of it. And from what I hear from professors, a lot of times that gap is that they're so unused to adding themselves into the conversation.
Yeah.
And that this kind of helps of, this is what I am looking at. You know, this is what other people have looked at. This is how I am changing what other people have said, you know, and using it to form my own ideas. So, I don't know. I think it kind of closely mirrors scientific journal articles. I'm sorry, I don't read much outside of the sciences, but I know in ours at least we have the four sections. Do you guys have this too, with the background and the methods and results and discussion?
Yeah, you definitely get that in the social sciences.
Okay. Yeah, and I think this is fairly similar of what has come before me, mm-hmm. what am I presenting, how did it turn out, what does it mean, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty fundamental outline right there. Yeah, sure.
Right.
One of the sources that he has the students read is actually a scientific journal article on, something about genetic modification of corn.
But yeah, I think this is kind of a twist on that, of starting to think about how to use all these different types of information mm-hmm. to contribute. So, I don't know. I think it's a really important concept for students to learn, maybe the most important concept yeah. that they get in college. And I don't know how many of them get it. But
well, and
I'm
it's a...
thinking,
oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I'm just... that when I was thinking back to my time as an undergrad, I think it took me quite a while to catch on to this fact that I wasn't supposed to just spit back what they had told me in class.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And take it and make something better out of it.
Right.
Yeah, that's the thinking about teaching students how to evaluate sources and thinking sort of big picture of like what you want to accomplish in a one shot. I've been wondering if other people have had the sense that I've had of that I wish we could spend. And maybe we could get away with spending less time teaching the mechanics of search and more weight evaluation of sources in our one shots and say, you know what, I'm going to spend 1 minute on Boolean and beyond that, screw it. And I'm going to spend 1 minute on picking databases and beyond that, screw it. Let's get into like the higher order, concepts that are things that we almost never have time to get to, but that are probably, and sort of lifelong literacy things, more valuable than the mechanics of search or how do you know if you're in the right database or how do you find a book, you know, or even the, I guess what I'm trying to move away from the basic how to library approach to library mm-hmm. instruction and more to how to research yeah. and how to create knowledge.
Well, yeah, I agree entirely. I've been talking in the last couple of shows about how I'm sort of learning how to teach senior classes after doing 10 years of mostly freshman English stuff. And they're really pretty bored when I show them how to search the databases. They want to know which databases to use, and mm-hmm. if I can show them advanced features and stuff that they haven't seen before, then that's great. But they're, I've been sensing a little bit of, we've heard this before, and this might be a lot more interesting. I need to, make a note to remind myself to listen to this episode again in a couple of months when I'm gearing up for the January instruction crush and come up with some class assignments, or better yet, I need to come up with some assignments now while it's the crush is easing off a little bit.
I think part of it also, there's another variable, I guess, is kind of getting, in a sense, getting the professor that you're collaborating with on board as well, because I think there are those professors out there that want five articles, and you're like, okay, well, let's kind of, can we maybe rephrase that or maybe flesh it out so they can work with the BEAM method. The BEAM method, is that right?
Yeah.
BEAM?
BEAM.
Okay. I'm going to make up my own little acronym here. just so that, I mean, I think that's part of an issue that could happen is that if the two parties aren't talking about it, then it might go fall by the wayside. Just a thought.
But, you know, even the classes where all the professor has told me is they need to have 5 articles, even if I went in with with this kind of thing, that's really all the background you need on the assignment to be able to apply this in some way. I mean, you'd need a little more than that, but you could go in and say, okay, you need these 5 articles. How do you choose these 5 articles? You need to figure out what you're going to do with them once you've found them, and so on.
That's true. That's very, very true. I guess I'm just thinking about the people who do like, and we've talked about this in past episodes, who they like us to show the catalog for the 20 millionth time.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
It's like, ugh.
I have a few of those too. Yeah.
That kind of thing.
I will say one thing I've started cutting out a lot more is exactly that, okay, this is how you do this, and this is how you do this, and in favor of giving more time for them to do it on their own, and then when they run into problems,
right?
You know, you can just be like, oh, well, you need to, you know, take out some of those keywords and add and, or, oh, if you click on this find it button, then you'll get to the full text. Because they seem to usually figure it out more or less, and I feel like it's so less important as compared to what you guys are talking about, the really critical thinking about research, and they're just not getting it anywhere else. And when I'm thinking about my top 3 learning outcomes, Boolean operators falls to like 6th.
I'm like, Boolean what?
I had a professor ask me in class the other day, what's that Boolean thing where she's, and I said, no, it's Boolean. It's named, I couldn't remember his first name, but Bool. And so I was like, yeah, it's just and or not. I kind of moved on.
But I do agree with Stephen. I could see this really coming into play at the reference desk quite often when you do have that one-on-one with the students, with the researchers.
Well, even if you're not giving them the list and the acronym, you could say, well, you need to have,
right.
You need to think about how you can use this. And even if, you know, if this isn't exactly on the same play that you're writing about, it's a theory that you could apply to this.
Exactly.
This other one. And I'm not stating that very well, but it makes sense. Yeah. Cool. Well, we're just about out of time, and I'm wondering if I know there are a couple of news and announcement-y sort of things. Stephen, do you have any publications or presentations or anything else you want to mention that you've got coming up before we move on?
No, all quiet on the Western Front.
This is usually Jason's time.
Well, one thing we do want to mention is that our friend friend of the show, Dana Longley, who has been on previously, has a new podcast called Wiggle Room, WGIL Room, which, if I remember right, stands for Working Group on Information Literacy, and she's got some of her colleagues up in New York State that have been talking about, you know, a lot of the same kinds of things that we talk about on the show. So we'll post a link to that in the show notes. I don't have the link in front of me to read out
it's
online.
It's wiglroom.blogspot.com.
wiglroom.blogspot.com.
And I highly there's only one episode up right now, and it is so good. It's e-readers, e-textbooks, where are we headed? And it's we have no idea. But it's a great listen.
I listened to it. I know she said they were just working on the last episode, and they have the next episode, that is, and they had some technical difficulties. So hopefully they'll have the second episode up soon.
But yeah.
Brand new podcast coming out. So I'm really pleased that we've got all of these other podcasts going about teaching in libraries, because it gives me something to listen to and get ideas from, aside from just what we're talking about. So I do have a couple of things coming up that I wanted to mention. One is I'm doing a presentation, online presentation, for the Georgia Library Association on the 17th of November. So, geez, that's in about 3 weeks. About open source software, why I think it's a good thing for libraries, and how Georgia libraries in particular are using it. This is open to non-Georgia attendees. It's got a really long URL, but it's linked at georgialibraries.org, and of course we'll post that in the show notes. And also, I'm really excited about this. I just got invited to the Web 2.U conference, which is in Montreal in February, and I'm going to be the keynote speaker. So So I just found out about this over the weekend, and I'll talk about it again when it's, you know, getting ready to come up. And hopefully I'll have something I can post online afterwards. But I'm really flattered and a little bit intimidated to be invited to be their keynote speaker, but I'm going to have to come up with something interesting to talk about. So I suspect it will be something about open source software and open access, and I might mention Zotero, just guessing, but, you know, we'll see.
You shouldn't be intimidated, Jason. You're going to be great. I mean, unless they ask you to present it in French, then maybe be a little nervous. But
that would be a little – I would need like a simultaneous translator. I would need Amy Buckland to stand up there next to me and repeat what I said in French. But, I, you know, presumably they know they invited an American there, so they won't expect me to know much about anything in French. So. That didn't come out quite as amusingly as I meant it to. Anyway, that's all I got going on at the moment. Do you guys have any announcements or anything?
No, you know what? I really don't at this point. I'm not presenting. I'm just blogging. I'm actually blogging more than I ever have it right now.
You're blogging way more than I am. I'm glad somebody is. Looks like we just dropped Rachel from the call. I think we just lost Rachel. So that might be the moment to close here. And if Rachel's got any links, we can add those to the show notes.
Yeah.
So thank you again, Stephen, for joining us. And thank you, Chad and Peter, who have left us. But we really appreciate all you guys taking the time to join us today. And we will certainly have to do this again soon. This was sort of a fun experiment to just invite everybody back and see who shows up. So
it was great. I have a list of things I want to go read some more about. So it really was nice talking with everybody. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me on again, too.
Great. And that was episode 19. This has been October 2010, and we'll catch you next month for episode 20. Thanks for listening. Bye. Adventures in Library Instruction is produced by Rachel Borcher, Jason Puckett, and Anna Van Skoik. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. To subscribe, go to our website at adlibinstruction.blogspot.com. Leave comments and suggestions on the blog or email us at adlibinstruction@gmail.com. Our opening theme song is Dropping Out of School by Brad Sucks, and our closing theme is Higher Education by the Napoleon Bonapartes. Both are available at magnatune.com.
Contact the library schools and the American Library Association. They are able to give you valuable advice.